Thank you, Ted. And thank you all for coming and believing that Bach is worth your time. If you've been to worship, you've heard a beautiful Bach cantata. If you haven't been yet, you will hear it. And I enjoyed watching the faces of the people in the congregation at 8:30, and it was truly inspiring to see how everyone was engaged. So Bach is still alive for all of us. Our final session focuses on Bach's legacy. This is a large and rather complex topic, to say the least. So I'll try to hit some high points that I hope you'll find interesting. Then we'll have our special guest, artist Sandy Conley, who will tell you how a Bach performance inspired her latest major artwork. Now let's begin with a few questions. How was Bach's music received and performed after his death? How did Bach become such a monumental figure in Western culture? And what's the place of Bach in today's world? We remember that before Bach died, he spent considerable time designing his legacy through the large works and collections we talked about in previous sessions. Printed works, such as the three parts of the Klavierübung, were circulated in elite musical circles. But it is the teaching works that were disseminated most widely. Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Mendelssohn, Schumann, Brahms, and countless others studied Bach. In particular, The Well-Tempered Clavier, two books of keyboard preludes and fugues in all 24 major and minor keys, quickly became standard for teaching both keyboard and composition. That continues today. The harmonized chorales followed over time to become the model for good part writing. They were, however, studied more than performed. Today, the chorales are part of every music student's study of harmony. Sometimes it's a student's first exposure to Bach. From Bach's death on, writers praised his music for its universality as art. Even as musical fashion changed, there was a recognition that Bach's music was something very special. In the later 18th century, the time of Haydn and Mozart, Bach was praised for combining an agreeable and flowing melody with the richest harmonies, features highly regarded in the classical and romantic eras. We know that Mozart had a brief spurt of interest in the music of Bach, Handel, and other old masters in the 1780s. At one point, he heard the beginning of Bach's double choir motet, Singet dem Herrn, and called out, "What is this?" When the singing stopped, he cried out with joy, "Now there is something one can learn from." Some of Bach's music was performed by Mozart and others, yet it wasn't until the 19th century that composers and performers began to look beyond the didactic function of Bach's music. You might ask why most of Bach's works essentially disappeared for a while. One reason is that styles had changed. Another compelling reason is that Bach composed music for professionals. Most of it wasn't easy to perform. Handel and Telemann, in contrast, targeted amateurs by writing works that could be performed by people with modest skills. This is one reason their music continues to be quite popular. Still, Bach's music attracted interest from composers because it was unique. You might call the values of Bach's music transcendent. Its melodic beauty, contrapuntal strength, rhythmic vitality, harmonic depth, all speak across time in a universal language to lots of composers. But despite near reverence for Bach's music, most composers felt compelled to make Bach's compositions their own by enhancing them in ways that reflected whatever style was current. They added parts, changed instruments, combined their own compositions with Bach's to make a hybrid piece, and on and on. Even Bach's sons did this. But isn't this what Bach himself did with Vivaldi's concertos and numerous works by other composers? He put his own stamp on his arrangements. So when we hear a piece for solo violin arranged for large orchestra, we can only acknowledge that this follows the model of Bach. A simple example of adjusting Bach for changing times is playing harpsichord pieces on the piano. Surely Bach would have done this. He would have adapted. And by the way, he was active in the development of the early piano called the pianoforte. And there's no doubt that Bach sounds good on the piano. So, as we look broadly at Bach's legacy, remember that altering his music or adjusting performances is a long-standing part of the picture. Going back to the 19th century, let's look at the state of Bach's vocal music, which had largely gone out of style. Even so, some composers were interested in earlier choral music. One was Beethoven, who certainly knew Bach from the well-tempered clavier. Yet, when he was looking for models of choral works, he studied the works of Handel because they were widely available, unlike most of Bach's choral works. But that was starting to change in Germany. The benchmark event for that change took place in 1829 when Felix Mendelssohn performed Bach's massive St. Matthew Passion in Berlin. The audience was ecstatic and incredulous. This positive reception had been preceded by a gradual increase in the public's affection for Bach's music, still mostly keyboard. In 1827, a noted Berlin music critic described this renewed interest in Bach as representing the sun of a new day in the fog of our times. With Mendelssohn's revival of the Matthew Passion, the sun rose fully, and the resurgence of Bach's music took off. Mendelssohn had long been fascinated by Bach, and you can hear Bach's influence in his music, particularly the organ works. Jewish by birth, Mendelssohn was a converted Lutheran drawn to the chorales of his adopted faith. His Symphony No. 5 is nicknamed the Reformation Symphony because it quotes a mighty fortress in the finale. He began composing the symphony late in 1829, not so long after his revival of the Matthew Passion. Bach lovers everywhere continue to be thankful for Mendelssohn's bold promotion of this profound work. England was slower to warm up to Bach, whose youngest son, Johann Christian, had settled in England and enjoyed fame as a virtuoso keyboardist and composer, but he didn't champion his father's works. The British musical hero was Handel, an untouchable icon, partly for reasons of national pride, but also because of the conservative taste of the British aristocracy and royal family. Despite the shadow of Handel, interest in the music of Bach did develop in the early 1800s, helped in large part by Samuel Wesley, son of the hymn writer Charles Wesley and the nephew of John, founder of Methodism. Samuel was a child prodigy at the keyboard, and he was also something of a rebel in the family. He converted to Roman Catholicism when he was a teenager. As an adult, he was a highly respected organist and composer, and he was a musical evangelist, working diligently through lectures and performances to convince the public that Bach's music was worthy. His enthusiasm was greatest for the fugues of the well-tempered clavier, again, keyboard music. And so, the English Bach movement grew with the help of Wesley and others, although Handel remained the primary British musical hero. In America, Handel was also popular in the early 19th century. The Handel and Haydn Society was founded in Boston in 1815 as an oratorio society. It gave the American premieres of Handel's Messiah in 1818, Haydn's Creation a year later, Verdi's Requiem in 1878, and finally, Bach's St. Matthew Passion in 1879. Bach got major traction in Pennsylvania in 1898 when the Bach Choir of Bethlehem was founded. And some of Bach's music was known before 1900 in certain churches and universities, but it was slow going overall in the U.S. Back in Germany, Robert Schumann, who died in 1856, was a composer, conductor, and music journalist who saw Bach not as the culmination of the Baroque era, but as an isolated genius whose compositions were the first in music history to show the same spiritual and poetic qualities found in the best works of the early Romantic period. In this description, you can see how Bach could become a legendary figure in the Romantic 19th century. And he did. His life, as well as his music, was often presented in ways that strayed far from the facts. Biographical writings included much conjecture. And late in the century, after the establishment of the German Empire in 1871, Bach was held up as a figure of German nationalism. But at least interest in Bach became strong and has stayed that way. Scholarship and performance developed steadily, and both have continued to be robust. The first major biography of Bach came out in 1802, and many others followed, especially after the centennial of Bach's death in 1850. But it wasn't until 1880 that Philipp Spitta completed a comprehensive, fairly objective biography that became the basis for later Bach studies. This biography is still readily available. Many, many more books on Bach followed, but the next major biography by Christoph Wolff and incorporating the best of Bach research came out only 16 years ago. Over the 20th century, the myths surrounding Bach were gradually replaced by solid, reliable information based on careful research. Building on this, the current century has seen interest in the historical and cultural context of Bach grow dramatically. Now, we better understand what life was like in Leipzig. For example, the politics of the local government, the influence of philosophy at the university, the effects of social change on religion, and so on. We still know precious little about Bach the person, but knowing more about the context enriches our experience of hearing and learning Bach's music. The religious aspect of Bach has always been acknowledged, but at times it was suppressed. The reasons for this are many, but there's no doubt that in the years after World War II, especially in Germany, the religious sincerity of Bach was pushed aside in favor of Bach's consummate technical skills as a composer. The German musicologists were meticulous scholars, but they shied away from much religious discussion. This surely had something to do with the Nazi takeover of the German Lutheran Church, which caused lasting embarrassment for German Lutherans. In West Germany, Bach's legacy as a great church musician wasn't really damaged. But in East Germany, where Bach lived and worked, and where the legacy of his faith should have been the strongest, communism ensured that Bach's faith was downplayed by scholars and citizens. Yet, Bach was still heralded as a great composer, and Bach research and performance went on, especially in Leipzig. In the last 30 years, Bach's faith has received much more serious attention from scholars. In Germany, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, all things Bach opened up in the East, including a full restoration of Bach's church in Leipzig. Organs from Bach's time began to be restored. the blessing in disguise here is that the instruments had not been modernized. They were barely cared for, but they weren't ruined during the communist years. This made for successful restorations of Bach organs. And Bach research now includes topics such as the composer's notations in his Bible and other religious books. Basically, the discussion of Bach and faith has both broadened and deepened. Bach's scholarship is thriving, including the religious part. What about Bach performances? The short answer is that now they are better than ever. But it's been an evolution. The romantic interpretation of Bach included heavier instrumentation, slower tempos, swelling dynamics, and a connected, often muddy sound. It lasted from the 19th century to well into the 20th. Although things began to slowly change, and by the 1960s, adventurous ensembles were trying to perform Bach's music in a way Bach would have recognized. Study of the instruments and performance practices of Bach's time led to performances using old-style instruments and a historically informed interpretation of the music. At first, the results were rough. Performances were often out of tune and lacking in natural musicality. Over the years, playing skills improved steadily, sometimes to the point of overkill, such as when a performer chooses ultra-fast tempos that show off technique but leave the subtlety of the music behind. Lately, that impulse has started to fade, but it's something to be wary of when you choose recordings to purchase. These days, even modern ensembles incorporate historically informed approaches to Bach and other early composers. You've seen this at the PSO, when a Bach or Handel orchestra is smaller and the playing and singing is clear and light on the vibrato. You'll see a harpsichord and often a continuo organ, and even early instruments such as the viola da gamba. Modern ensembles also increasingly use theatrical gimmicks to make old music relevant to new audiences. Sometimes this is effective and successful. Other times it seems too contrived, but at least the music is getting out to a broader audience. Early music ensembles, which focus on music before 1800, are more purist in their approach. And the best of these groups achieve outstanding results, graceful, stylish, and very musical. Pittsburgh's own Chatham Baroque is an excellent example. The performance standards are high, and the players truly understand the music and communicate it convincingly. They play early instruments, which are either original, as in very old, or replicas. And the sound is distinctive. For example, the string tone is pleasantly smooth, not harsh. The Baroque violin is a very different instrument from the modern violin. Its gut strings and unique bow style contribute to an authentic Baroque sound. Listening to the best early music groups opens up a whole new world of music, including familiar works by Bach. Hearing how the music might have sounded when it was first performed is enlightening and often moving. This is a great time to enjoy live performances and recordings of early music, Bach and much more. It's certainly worth trying, even if you decide you prefer modern performances. Your next chance to hear early music at Westminster is coming on Friday evening, November 18th, when Chatham Baroque will perform in this room and Bach is on the program. I happen to have a stack of season brochures. Take one if you are at all interested, even if you're just curious. I have plenty. Using original instruments sticks close to Bach's world. At the other extreme, we see performances that intentionally present interpretations of Bach, ranging from the recreation of a 1909 New York concert where Gustav Mahler presented movements from the orchestral suites, to electronic and jazz takes on Bach, and of course, much more. Through it all, the essence of Bach's music is left intact. You simply cannot totally mess it up. And everyone is entitled to an opinion. Choose and enjoy the Bach performances that you like. And I think this is enough of the highlights of Bach's legacy. I'd like to take time for just a few questions, and then we'll turn it over to Sandy Connolly and the visual arts. Yes. Well, it is hard. It is hard. Two of the movements for the choir are really quite easy, but the first one took a lot of work. And as I think I mentioned, Bach's music is often not so easy. And he really didn't care from a business standpoint about writing music for amateurs and selling it. He was a devoted church musician, and that was fine with him. Handel and Telemann both had much more business-oriented approaches. Any other questions? Any ideas about how you see Bach today? Yeah.
I'll ask. There was a double bass today, Jeff. And he seemed to me to anchor things. Is that part of it?
That's true. The double bass and the cello are part of what's called the basso continuo. Those bass instruments, along with the organ, play along with everything in Baroque music, almost. Not quite. But it's the foundation of the music. And the bass line is truly a foundation of Baroque music because it's always just very reliable and steady. And the harmonies above that were written in figures, in numerals, that would tell the keyboard player, whether it was harpsichord or organ, what chords to play. But it was up to the player to improvise and play those chords and make them lovely. And you heard that this morning, too. All that lovely organ stuff was not written by Bach. It's called realization of the continuo. But the foundation is the bass line, and then the keyboard instrument also plays the bass line. So it is truly, it's the anchor. That's a good term for it. One more question? No? Well, then I think we're in for a visual treat. Sandy Connolly, I think, is a wonderful example of how Bach's music continues to inspire people. And she will tell you her story. But it did inspire me to hear it when she called me about a year ago.
It's been a while.
Yeah, to say that she was just in love with this piece and had to do an artwork based on it. So I'll let her share that with you, and we'll pass the microphone.
Can you hear me? Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you, Sarah, and thank you all for coming today. I appreciate your interest in Bach Bereaved. You got the first one up there. Thank you, Ted. I'm attempting to describe over a year's worth of work in a 20-minute talk. So, quickly, here's my story. September 26, 2015 was a red letter date for me. That evening, under the direction of Manfred Honeck, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra was set to perform Johann Sebastian Bach's Chaconne. As we walked into Heinz Hall, I had no idea I was about to have a life-changing experience. That experience actually started with the pre-concert lecture by Francesco Lecce-Chong. What he conveyed prepared me to be an active listener that evening. And here is some of what he told us. He defined a chaconne as a type of musical composition popular in the Baroque era when it was much used as a vehicle for variation on a repeated short harmonic progression. Now, you musicians will understand that a lot better than I did at the time. The Bach Chaconne is the fifth movement of Partita No. 2 in D minor. It is an unusually long movement. The first four movements of the partita combined are not as long as the 17-minute fifth movement, which is the chaconne. The musical phrase that opens the chaconne is followed by 63 variations of that main musical phrase. In other words, every four measures, Bach begins a new variation on that main musical phrase. Bach wrote the piece for solo violin around 1720. The chaconne is one of the most challenging solo pieces to play on violin. Over the years, it has been transcribed for full orchestra and for many solo instruments. Lecce-Chong also shared the backstory, which I found to be very moving. Legend has it that Bach wrote the chaconne in memory of his first wife, Maria Barbara. Tragically, during the summer of 1720, while Bach was away from home for a few months playing music in Karlsbad for his patron, Prince Leopold, Maria Barbara died suddenly. He only learned of her death and burial upon his arrival back home in Curtin, days or even weeks after her death. Needless to say, Bach was devastated. By the end of the lecture, I was intrigued with the chaconne and ready to be an active listener. I looked forward to trying to recognize the musical phrasing as the piece progressed. My plan was to see if I could count out the 64 musical phrases as they were being played. Now, I'd like you to hear the opening section of the chaconne in a musical arrangement similar to what we heard that evening. We will hear the first 24 measures of the chaconne. See if you can pick out the six repeated phrases in this clip, and I will note the beginning of each musical phrase.
Thank you.
So did you hear it? Yeah? Good. Well, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra played the chaconne beautifully. And during that 17-minute performance, I resolved to visually interpret this piece of music. Well, why the chaconne? I fell in love, as Sarah said, head over heels in love with this music. It has everything that I value in art. Solid structure. It evokes emotion. Its complexity is undeniable. And its beauty is pure delight. In my reading, I found a quote from violinist Joshua Bell. He says, "Bach's chaconne is not just one of the greatest pieces of music ever written, but one of the greatest achievements of any man in history. It's a spiritually powerful piece, emotionally powerful, and structurally perfect." So, the way forward. Well, this is what I resolved to do. Make 64 pieces of visual art which interpret the 64 musical phrases contained in Bach's chaconne. Make a video that combines the visual art with the corresponding musical phrases. Show the art and video in venues that feature J.S. Bach at festivals, concerts, churches, and music and art departments. Yikes. Yeah. So, where to begin? Well, I began in the same place that Bach did, by placing glory to God alone, first and foremost. Soli Deo Gloria. My work is often the focus of my prayers, and from the very beginning, I have known this work to be blessed, every step of the way. I have attempted to heed God's still small voice as church choices have been made about the project. I shared my vision with my husband, Paul, on the way home from Heinz Hall that night. He has been a very supportive source of help ever since. It is my greatest blessing to have a life partner who is extremely supportive. Up until the night of the chaconne performance, I knew very little about J.S. Bach, let alone about the chaconne. I spent a lot of hours listening to many renditions of the chaconne, orchestral, solo violin, classical guitar, even marimba. There are a lot of YouTubes of the chaconne out there. I read about about Bach and the chaconne. I read Johann Sebastian Bach, The Learned Musician, by Christoph Wolff, as Sarah says. Not too good with the pronunciation. The New Bach Reader, Violin Dreams, and An Evening in the Palace of Reason. I even attempted to work my way through a couple of doctoral dissertations that I found online, which were focused on the various aspects of the chaconne. I talked about the project with many of you and many others. I am so grateful for the ideas and thoughts that were generated by these conversations. It all factored into the direction my visual interpretation would take. After much conversation, thought, and prayer, I decided the 64 paintings should illustrate Soli Deo Gloria, Bach's life in 1720, and his tribute to Maria Barbara. For the past few years, I have been working with wooden boxes and mixed media in a series called Small Obsessions. I'm going to pass around some of the boxes. This is a small obsession that I made for my sister a few years ago. There's my sister. This is a raw wooden box that I start with. And drop anything. And this is a gessoed wooden box with the paper boxes that I used in the Bach Chaconne project, or the Bach Bereaved project. Okay. That's right. I did say I wanted to wait. The Bach Bereaved project is made of 64 wooden boxes and a total of 1,152 handmade paper boxes, as well as many found objects inserted throughout the piece. On December 7th, 2015, right here in the chapel, I photographed two models so I would have good reference for my design. It was a truly amazing, blessed experience. I was looking for lighting that would be dramatic. At the time of day we chose, the lighting was perfect. And while we were shooting, we were accompanied by Sarah Kyle practicing a Bach sonata on the organ. I could not have planned a more amazing experience if I tried. So over the next 8 weeks, the basic design came together, with many details being worked out in the full charcoal sketch. That's on the right. I also knew that I had to get started making the paper boxes. It took about 6 weeks for me to make them all. Realize there is not just an outer box, but also an inner box, which helps to strengthen the outer hollow box. And so, it was a work in progress. I painted, thought, repainted, prayed, listened, dreamed, talked, and I had the time of my life. What you are seeing now are some of the areas that have changed significantly. For example, there is no longer a bridge over the brook. One of the most significant changes is the shape of the overall piece. It went from a static square to a more interesting shape, which you will see in the next slide. And this is the final design. Each individual box had to be fashioned not only as an integrated part of the overall, but also to stand alone as well as a well-designed art piece. I kept envisioning each piece as it would appear in the video, accompanied with the music. There are three key changes in the music which helped me make decisions about how to assign the boxes to the music. The first section is in D minor and is the longest, 33 passages. I have made 33 of the boxes to depict Sebastian Bach and Maria Barbara's life together, and they are mainly in the foreground. Next, there is a key change to D major, and it goes for 19 passages. Those 19 boxes refer to Sebastian Bach's longing and remembrance of his wife. Then the final key change, back to D minor for 12 passages, deals with Bach's entrusting his beloved to God. There is a lot of symbolism included in the design, which I don't have time to go into today. Let me just say that the more you look, the more you see. So, in a little over a year, I have completed the 64 pieces of art. And I'm happy to put a check mark beside the first phase of the project. Now it is time to move on to making the video. Videographer Dan McCoskey is set to put together the sequencing and animation of each piece of art as it corresponds with the music. The video will be about 20 minutes long. I'm excited that Dan is set to photograph the art pieces on November 12th. I really look forward to working with him on this part of the project, since even making a passable PowerPoint is a challenge for me. Sebastian Bach originally wrote the chaconne for solo violin. I decided that should be the rendition used for the soundtrack of the video. I asked Ellen Chen Livingston, a member of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, to record the chaconne for the soundtrack. A week and a half ago, at David's Music House in Canonsburg, that happened. Good, I'm up there. Okay. Brian Smith is the sound engineer who is editing the music. I'm going to play a video clip from when we were listening to the playback of one of Ellen's recordings. What you will hear are the same passages we heard earlier, played by the orchestra. I love watching Ellen's and Brian's intensity as they discern each note they hear. It's Brian's job to knit together the best parts of each take into one final recording, and I look forward to hearing the finished soundtrack soon. As I said, I hope to eventually show the original art and video in venues that feature J.S. Bach, at Bach festivals, concerts, churches, and music and art departments. My hope is that this project will provide Paul and I with an interesting travel schedule in the next few years. For the first time in my rather long artistic career, I have had the privilege of no deadlines. This project is moving forward based on a reliance on God's grace and guidance. As I said initially, this past year has been blessed. I have confidence that in the end, God will once again be glorified through the visual interpretation of one of Bach's most amazing compositions, the Chaconne. And finally, Johannes Brahms, in a letter to Clara Schumann in June 1877, said about the Chaconne, "On one stave, for a small instrument, the man writes a whole world of the deepest thoughts and most powerful feelings. If I imagined that I could have created, even conceived, the piece, I am quite certain that the excess of excitement and earth-shattering experience would have driven me out of my mind." What a tribute to Bach the artist. And I feel confident that Bach would have answered Brahms by saying, "Soli Deo Gloria," glory to God alone. Thank you. Anybody have any questions? Yeah. No deadlines. Pray about it, Jan, as I am. We'll see. It really is kind of on track. You know, if I would do a best guess, I would say February, March, something like that. So I have to find a place to do a an opening, and we'll go from there, and you'll all be invited. So I really, really appreciate your interest in this. Who knew? I mean, truly, I never looked for this kind of project, but it just kind of came to me. So, yeah.
What kind of projects have you had before?
Oh, well, in my 45 years of working in the art field, I started out in commercial art, and then watercolor. I've used any number of media. After having children, decided to just kind of focus on fine art or painting, that sort of thing. So I'm an experimenter. And those wooden boxes that you saw were kind of one of those unique experiments. They are unique. Yes.
Now I remember you had some artwork with the boxes many years ago.
It's probably
the only one. Is that where the idea came from? Was that first?
Oh, no, the wooden boxes were first, probably about 7 or 8 years ago, and they've sort of evolved. I'll tell you the story. A dear friend of mine says, maybe gloss over this, but to be honest, I walked into the dollar store one day, and these raw wooden boxes were on the shelf. And I guess it's in my nature to just sort of be stopped by certain things, and Bach on the one hand and something in the dollar store on the other. But I picked up these wooden boxes and thought, oh, I can do something with these. And over the course of probably 7 or 8 years, I have done many things with these boxes. So actually, I have one more that is going to Marilyn Hayes, if you want to wait. I don't know how long we have. Sarah, give me a high sign when we... Oh, good. Okay. Well, my dear friend Marilyn Hayes said she wanted to buy this one. I'm not going to pass it around, but but this is typical of the type of thing that I've done before with these boxes. Just... Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, they are small. So,
can you also talk about the artistic wood you used to get out?
Oh, sure. Yeah, as I walk, my friend Jan was suggesting that I talk about the mixed media that I'm using for the Bach project. And that's exactly what it is. It's mixed water media, basically, you know, watercolor, gouache, and some acrylic. And then...
What are your boxes made out of?
The boxes?
The boxes you used.
Oh, the paper boxes?
You have to name this boxes of box.
I know. It's true. Boxes of box. You're right. But, yeah, the actual boxes are made out of paper, and I actually, you know, fashion those. I have a video. I didn't want to include that, but I, of how to make the actual little boxes, and then paint and, plastic and all sorts of things are kind of go into that. I'm a free form kind of artist, so yeah. I did at one point with workable fixative, and then work over it, and eventually when I'm finished tweaking, then it will be sealed again. Because yeah.
So each little box, each individual box, is one of those formative phrases.
Correct.
And how do you know, in your mind, how do you connect them? How do you know where how to go from one to the next?
I think the video, it's going to be interesting to see how the video plays out, because I don't have a complete script. But as I described, the three movements within the chaconne, the D minor, D major, and D minor, have kind of dictated how I divide up the design. And so the first movement is going to basically be, let's see, I guess I do have a pointer, basically be, oh, that's the wrong one. Okay, anyway, of the overall design, the foreground of will be used in the flow of the video. And it won't just be a static show that one box and move on. My intention is to kind of have Dan pan out and in so that the story can kind of be told. It's probably going to have a brochure that goes along with it. or something, you know, there will have to be some explanation that goes along with, but haven't worked all that out just yet. But. Maybe. Would you like to narrate? No. That's to be determined. So, but my ultimate goal is, you know, much like, unless you know a lot about Bach. Like me, I didn't know a lot about it. I just responded to the emotion, to the beauty of the music. And I guess I'm looking to make my interpretation be something that people will respond to the beauty of the artwork and the music. And they don't necessarily have to know a narrative kind of story, but they can. And there is one. And so, you know, my hope is to make that story known, but it doesn't have to be that you know that. Are we done? Okay. Oh, one more question? Yeah.
Do you foresee that this is going to be an installation somewhere where people can see it?
I foresee it, yes. That's my goal, is that it will be an installation where you'll see the original art and then you'll be able to view the video at various places. We'll kind of take it here and there. But a permanent installation, hey, you know, we'll see. Anything can happen, but I sort of doubt that. But thanks for asking. And thank you all for coming.